This week's parasha is Toldos. Toldos, we get introduced to two new characters, one of which is going to take us all the way through the end of the book of Bereishis, and that's Yaakov. The other is his brother, Esav. And just to make you all feel a little bit better, right away when they're introduced, we realize that the family that they come from is a quite dysfunctional family, totally lacking symmetry. We're told about a father who loves one child, a mother who loves another child. And to compound the problem, not only told that Yitzchak loves Esav, but it says that his love for him is based upon something which sounds conditional. But Yehav Yitzchak is Esav Kitzai Befiv. Yitzchak loves Esav because of his mouth, Tzayid Befiv, meaning that he hunted with his mouth, meaning that Esav was very sly and said things that caused Yitzchak to love him. Or it means that he literally provided food for the mouth of Yitzchak, which is actually something which would be a little disappointing to us, because we would like to believe that our forefathers and mothers were spiritual giants to the extent that just because somebody brings them some rib steak, listen, I also love rib steak, I understand this, but I don't love my butcher because of this. I mean, I like him, but love would be a little bit strong of a term to use. So that's something which would really be quite strong. But I want to just make the question even somewhat stronger. We're told over here that Yitzchak loves Esav, and the Haftorah that we normally read, that we won't be reading this week, tells us that God hates Esav. So now, if God hates Esav, it's Esav sin Esav. If God hates Esav, so then why in the world would Yitzchak love him? Even if it is conditional, and that's something which disturbs us. There's another thing that we have to be very careful about, and that is that throughout rabbinic literature, going certainly into the Middle Ages, whenever Esav's name comes up, we have to be careful if they're talking about the biblical character Esav, or if perhaps they're speaking about people that are associated with Esav, perhaps through descendants of Esav, or perhaps ideologically connected to Esav, and that would be called Rome. Which means in rabbinic literature, Rome is identified with Esav. When I say Rome, I'm not speaking specifically about a city called Rome, but rather about Christianity. So therefore, when the Romans destroy the temple, that is seen as being Esav hating Yaakov. When throughout history, going on from the temple's destruction, and now you can pause any place that you want, going through the Crusades, going through the Khmelnytsky massacres, going through the Holocaust, all of this coming from the Christian attitudes towards Jews, that's seen as going back to the biblical antecedents of the relationship between Yaakov and Esav. And when God tells us in the book of Malachi that I hate Esav, one doesn't know if by the time that the prophet is prophesizing, if he's speaking about, again, the biblical character himself, Esav, or if it's talking about what comes out or is associated with Esav. Furthermore, when one reads through the Midrashic and the Talmudic comments on the Parsha, one finds that Esav is guilty of every single crime that you can imagine, and I can add probably a handful of crimes that you can't imagine. It has him doing every single indignity, every single outrage Esav is guilty of, and when one actually looks at the biblical text, there is not all that much that he's guilty of, but I do want to spend some time today to look at the things that he, even from the Torah itself, even if you at first want to distance yourself from the rabbinic or the midrashic comments to it as being something external, let's even look what the Torah itself says, and then we can decide exactly why the rabbi said what they said. Because the Torah itself, even though on one level perhaps Esav can be a sympathetic character, I mean, you think about it. His father wants to give him a blessing, and next thing you know, Yaakov dresses up as him and steals his blessing. It doesn't sound so nice. He comes in from the field all hungry, and his brother will only give him food if he's willing to pay for it. That also doesn't sound all that nice. So I'm saying when you read through the text on a simple level, and I would venture to say on a too simple of a level, then Esav can actually emerge as a sympathetic character, and perhaps he would if we were not rooting for Yaakov as one often roots for the home team. When Esav Okay, and let me just say a couple things also, just to get this out of the way and to make this easier, and then we'll be able to proceed. This problem of Yitzchak loving Esav is not as profound as I'm setting it up. Again, let me be very clear about this. First of all, even the love that it expresses here is a conditional love. Once it's a conditional love, it almost sounds like it's Yitzchak looking for a reason to love him. In a normal circumstance, a father doesn't have to justify why he loves his kid. Why does he love his kid? Because it's his kid. Not, I love my kid because he brings me food. Something wrong about that. Which means it almost sounds as if Yitzchak is overcompensating. And maybe we need to move back a little bit and to think about what is it that we know about the biblical character of Yitzchak. And the answer is very little. Of the three forefathers of Abraham, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we know the least about Yitzchak. And what we do know about him, more often than not, he's passive. And within his passivity, we find it very difficult to understand things about him, who he really is. If you wanted to write a book, an article, a play, a movie, you can make a musical about Avraham, you have a lot of material. If you want to write a Yaakov, you even have more material. If you write Yitzchak, you don't have all that much material. The scene of the Akedah is one major scene, but again, he's passive. His dating and marriage, he does it by proxy, which, by the way, may be a wonderful idea. It can spare you a lot of bad dates, send someone else instead of you. Think about it. You can open a business. The one thing that he does do is he re-digs the wells of his father. So who is Yitzchak? He is a well re-digger. Now that itself is quite interesting. It means he's not a trailblazer in the sense of creating his own path or even digging his own wells, or even imitating his father and digging wells. He re-digs his father's wells. There may be a couple of episodes that when we consult, again, between the lines, we can appreciate this. First of all, in last week's portion, we had a very tender and an interesting comment that Rashi puts forward to us. Avraham, after the death of his wife, is concerned with the continuity of the Jewish people, even though there's only two Jewish people at that time, Avraham and Yitzchak. And having only two, and they're both being males, and father and son, there's probably good reason to be concerned about the continuity. And therefore, he needs to go and find a wife for Yitzchak. As I said, Yitzchak is passive. At the end of that whole episode, we're told that Yitzchak then goes and looks for a wife for his father. And matter of fact, it tells us, because all the Torah says here is that Avraham, later on in his life, married a woman named Keturah. Rashi tells us that Keturah is none other than Hagar, somebody that Avraham used to be with. And who are we told that reintroduces Avram to Hagar? It's Yitzchak. So therefore, he fixes an old relationship. So what would I call that? You don't get it yet. Redigging a well. He's redigging an old well. He's fixing an old relationship. That's interesting. Second point, and this is in the text. When his proxy comes back from his extended date and brings back his new wife, where do they find Yitzchak having come from? This is a very subtle point, but essential. Where was Yitzchak? Right? In the field, good. Well, and where had he come from when he was in the field? It says he was in Be'er. Where? Which Be'er? Which well? Which one? L'chai ro'i. And what's the significance of that well? That's the well where Yishmael had the epiphany. This is fascinating. You would think that the place that Yitzchak would go to have a spiritual experience, or you would hope the place that he goes for a spiritual experience, would have been the Har HaBayit, would have been Har HaMoriah, would have been Jerusalem. Although we would allow that perhaps he had a traumatic episode there, and he keeps having visions of his father coming after him with a knife, and therefore it's not the place that he seeks out to find spiritual guidance. Be that as it may, the fact that he chooses as an alternative location for his spiritual endeavors is the well of Yishmael, that would seem to indicate to me that Yitzchak is trying to fix that relationship as well, trying to heal that relationship. And again, think about his perspective. When he's born, what happens to his brother? He gets chased out of the house. Again, I'm not going to psychoanalyze Yitzchak. I'm not going to psychoanalyze one of the Avot. I'm not going to psychoanalyze somebody who's been dead for 4,000 years. Very hard to get them on a couch. But if we can have a little bit of sensitivity and a little bit of insight, it would seem to be that Yitzchak perhaps feels that because of his birth, the family broke up. Because of his birth, his half-brother got sent away. So maybe he feels part of his job is to, again, to re-dig wells. Part of his job is to fix relationships. Part of his job is to bring Hagar back. Part of his job is to bring Yishmael back. And then you realize that all of these things that he's doing all has one common denominator. What is that? Yitzchak re-digs wells, fixes relationships, tries to make things as they once were. Again, that's interesting. Keeping that in mind, what do you do when you have two kids and one of them is the golden child and the other is a loser? Do you just say, well, this is the favorite child and the other one off? Or do you try to find something good about the other one and try to find something that he's good at, try to find something you can do with him, try to find something about him you can love? That seems to be what's going on. Just in order to back this up and to explode another myth. People are under the assumption, and again, I don't know why. I do know why, because they don't actually read. When they do read, they don't remember what they read. And if they do remember what they read, they never understood what they read. So that's a very bad combination. People are under the assumption that Yitzchak loved Esav, and consequently he wanted to give his special blessing to Esav. Correct? And he tells Esav, bring me food and so on and so forth, I'm going to give you a blessing before I die. So therefore it's simple. Yitzchak loved Esav, wanted to give him the blessing. There's only one problem with that. There were three different blessings to consider in this week's portion. One blessing is the blessing, stay with me, so I don't have to say this too many times. The first blessing is the blessing that Yitzchak gives Yaakov when he thinks he's Esav. Blessing number one. The blessing Yitzchak gives Yaakov when he thinks he's Esav. Blessing number two, that he gives Esav when he knows it's Esav. Blessing number three, the one he gives Yaakov when he knows it's Yaakov. So, the first blessing is basically a blessing for physicality, for strength, for victory. Second blessing is a lower grade blessing for physicality. The third blessing is a blessing for who will inherit the land of Israel, and a blessing who will receive the blessing of Abraham. Now, that last blessing I just mentioned, the blessing of Abraham in the land of Israel, well, what exactly does that mean? That means the continuity of the Jewish people. Who does Yitzchak give that blessing to? That's the one he gives to Yaakov when he knows it's Yaakov. Do I have to prove my point anymore? That's not the blessing he was going to give to Esav when he thought it was Esav. Then he gave a blessing for physicality. Apparently, what Yitzchak believes is that Yaakov is more spiritual, but he believes that Esav is more physical, and he believes that somehow we can bring the two of them together and have them on a joint mission. That's what he seems to believe. So, going on through life, what you have, is Yitzchak preaching one for all and all for one. And what you have, right, sort of this two musketeer kind of thing going on. And what you have Rivka, the mother, saying, it's not going to happen, your brother's a loser. Now, how does she know this? It says God spoke to her when she was pregnant. And God said, the younger one will prevail. The younger one will be successful. So she has inside information. And again, to make all this very simple, because Yitzchak wasn't wrong. Yitzchak's vision that the two will work together was right. But there's only one problem about Yitzchak that you need to understand. The name Yitzchak means? What tense is it? Past, present, or future? Future. That means Yitzchak has a view of the future. Yitzchak is not present tense. So what does Yitzchak see? He sees the day when Esav and Yaakov go together and work together and go off into the sunset. What's the problem? It's not today. It's the future, which means one day this will happen. And you read the prophets. One day the children of Esav will come over to Yaakov and say, you know what, we bet on the wrong horse. We're sorry. We messed up. How can we help you? How can we make things right? That's going to happen. Esav will, at the end of days, come and help Yaakov. But Yitzchak sees a vision of the end of days. Yitzchak is a visionary. And by the way, seeing the world through the prism or through the eyes that had been on top of the altar and on the Beis HaMikdash, and on that first Mizbeach, looking up into the heavens, you probably see the world in a slightly different manner than most people do. At which point does Yaakov realize that his mother is right and his father is wrong? And by the way, realize how difficult this must be for Yaakov. His father says, you're both going to work together, even though Yaakov is far more talented. His mother is saying, forget about your brother, stop carrying him. It's not going to happen. Your father's dream is not going to happen now. Now, at which point does Yaakov realize this? It says that Yaakov makes some food, and Esav's job was the physical son, the hunter, to go out and bring food for his brother. What happens when he comes in from the field? What does he say? He says to his brother Yaakov, give me some food because I am... You guys read the book? You see the movie? What do you say? Give me some food because I am... Which is very interesting, because it should have been, give me food because I'm hungry. So what does it mean, give me food because I'm tired? What do you say when you're tired? Give me a bed, give me a pillow. Why give me food because I'm tired? So tiredness over here may have many other kind of connotations. Tiredness could be the result of depression, and there is a whole approach within the Midrash that in fact Esav was depressed. The reason he was making a meal at this point, that Yaakov made a meal, is because Avram had died that day. And the first time in his life that Esav had to face death and realize people die became a traumatic episode for him, to the extent that he wasn't able to get past it. And he said, why bother? Why bother being good? Why bother leading a good life? Why bother making good decisions? If the greatest person in the world, the greatest person in the history of the world to that point, and as I said last week, arguably one of the most impactful people in the history of the world, if he can die, so why bother trying to do the right thing? And according to the Midrash, at that point, Esav just gives up. But the tiredness then would be an indication of depression. Depression would be that he's a victim of the problem of theodicy. Why bad things happen to good people cripples him emotionally. And he gets to the point that he says, I just can't function anymore. The other possibility is that when he says, I'm tired, that it's not necessarily depression or physical tiredness. He's tired of role-playing. He's tired of living up to his father's expectations. He's tired of trying to be the person that he isn't. And he says, I'm tired, not I'm hungry. You take care of me instead of me taking care of you. Either way, at this point, Yaakov realizes that the father's dream of them working together is not going to happen. And as I said, at least at this point in history. Day perhaps will come, we should live and see it, when Esav will come and take responsibility and say, I've made a mistake, let me try to fix that. But if I want to go back and understand his superficiality, or the limits to Esav, there's a couple things I want to point out. One, at that point when Yaakov says, if you want food and if you're in fact tired, then give me the role of being the firstborn. And perhaps we have no idea what that means, the role of the firstborn. One of the commentaries, the Targum Yonatan, points out, that when it says the firstborn, in ancient Judaism, the firstborn was supposed to be the one who would serve as the Kohen in the temple. And Esav didn't want a part of it. He didn't want to spend his life working in the temple. He preferred to spend his life out hunting and doing whatever the things that he did. Why spend his life as a rabbi? He could have more fun outside. And when Yaakov says, you want me to give you food, then I want to be the firstborn, he goes, fine, take it. But then the verse says, Vayivez Esav es habechora. He detested the role of firstborn. That's a very strong word. Detested it. To say you don't want it, you don't want to live it, he detested it. There's another possibility about what was included in this. The one thing that they should have known at that point in terms of Jewish history and Jewish destiny was the covenant that God made with Abraham. What was the covenant? The covenant was, you are my people, I am for you a God, I will give you the land of Israel, but you're going to be slaves. You're going to be slaves 400 years, and then you're going to come back. It could be that Esav did not want to be a slave. It could be that Esav did not want that responsibility. It could be that he detested the role. It's also just a strange thing, and I'll just say it in passing, that one of the things when it says that Said Befiv, that he misled his father, he would ask him all kinds of questions. And one of the questions they asked him, do you take a tenth from straw? The only place that we see straw coming up in the Torah is when the Jews needed straw in order to make, to build what they were building in Egypt. So it's interesting that straw may have been on his mind, at least according to the Midrashic approach. So as I said, that's interesting. Also, to take a tenth is fascinating because does Esav ever really give a tenth? Yaakov is the one in the beginning of next week's portion that says that God shall take care of me and I will give a tenth of everything that I have. So over here we have Esav detesting the role of firstborn. That tells us something about character. The second thing that disturbs us is in the beginning of this week's portion, we're told these are the generations of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. Avraham fathered Yitzchak. Yitzchak was 40 years old when he got married. Okay? 40 years old, he married Rivka. We then turn to this verse right before Yitzchak gets old and wants to give the blessing. And I'm referring to chapter 26, Perek Avav, the last two verses, Pasuk Lamed Aleph Lamed Hey. It says, and when Esav was 40 years old, he took a wife. Now, superficially, that's wonderful. Why? He did exactly what his father did. So he takes two wives. By the way, that itself is disturbing. Okay, time to settle down, start a family, take two wives. Two wives, I don't want to get into this more than necessary, but taking two wives is a very sexist thing to do. And you don't know why I'm saying that. The first person in the Torah to take two wives was Lemech. The rabbis explained to us, why would Lemech take two wives? One was to produce children, and the other was to be a companion. One was not supposed to get pregnant, she would be the beautiful wife, and the other was there to produce children. Now the reason why this is sexist, instead of looking at a woman as an organic whole, this looks at a woman in terms of utility, what she can do for me. So you have one wife produces child, that means you're only looking at a woman in terms of functionality. The other one is beautiful, so therefore you only want her for her body. The Torah never saw it this way. The Torah's understanding is that a wife is something which is part of a whole relationship, and therefore man should leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife. That's an absolute statement of equality, existentially and spiritually, ontologically. And that's what the Torah's ideal is. Not an ideal that go right away and get two wives. Esav's going off and getting two wives right over here is somewhat disturbing. The fact that he chooses local women is even more disturbing because this is one of the things that we're specifically told that his father was forbade and that his grandfather tried to guarantee that he would not marry one of the local women. So he goes, gets married, but again, superficially, he's just like his father. The next verse tells us, V'tiyena moras ruach liyitzuk l'rivka. And this was something which called an incredible amount of bitterness for his parents, his mother and his father, Yitzchak and Rivka. Even though Esav enjoys the reputation of respecting his father, and I will point out, never are we told of his relationship with his mother. Over here we're told both of his parents are quite disappointed in his choice. Later on, right after this whole episode of the stealing of the blessing, we're told that Rivka turns to her husband, to Yitzchak, and says, "V'tomer Rivka al Yitzchak." This is in chapter 27, verse 46. "V'tomer Rivka al Yitzchak, katzti b'chayai b'bnei b'noschet." I really can't stand these girls that Esav had married. "Im lokech Yaakov isha b'noschet, ke'elam b'nos ha'aretz lama lichayin." If my other son Yaakov will take women like this, I don't even know why I'm alive. Okay, maybe she's being overly dramatic. But nonetheless, you understand her attitude, which already we've heard before. Yaakov is then summoned in, and he's told by his father, he blesses him, and he tells him, don't take a wife from the local girls, rather go back to the hometown of your mother, and that's where you should try to find someone to marry. And at that point, he gives him v'itein lechad birkas Avraham, and God will give you the blessing of Avram, ulecha lazarcha itach ulereshtecha es eretz mugurecha Asher nasan l'kim l'Avram, and you will inherit the land which God gave to Avram. I said that before. God gives him here the blessing of Abraham and the land that was guaranteed to Abraham. So then we're told that he sent away, he goes, and then this week's portion ends with the following two verses. Vayar Esav ki ra'os benos Kanan be'enei Yitzchak aviv. Esav then sees or realizes, understands that these girls, these local girls from Canaan, are not acceptable in the eyes of Yitzchak, his father. Not a word about his mother. Vayelech Esav el Yishmael. Esav goes to Yishmael. Vayikach es mochalas bas Yishmael ben Avraham achos nivyos al nashav lo leisha. He goes and he marries the daughter of Yishmael in addition to his other wives, because his parents were upset with his choice of wife. Now, if he's really going to change his life because of an appreciation of his parents' values, what he should have then done was distance himself from these women that he now understands are unacceptable. But what does he do instead? Well, my parents don't like this wife, I'll get another wife that they want. Which means, by the way, it's even further seeing women in terms of utility. I have one wife to fool around with, one wife to raise the children, and another wife to make tea for my parents come to visit. Which means his whole attitude towards women is one absolute of utility and not one of a holistic life partner. Okay, that's part of the attitude about Esav that I think that we can be somewhat disappointed with. But I want to take this to a whole other level. As I said in the beginning, when we find comments about Esav or Edom, Rome, we always have to be careful whether it's speaking about the biblical character or what emerges later. When we find discussions about Yishmael, we have to be careful. Are we speaking about the biblical character, or are we talking about the nation of Islam that comes afterwards? We have over here a verse, which on the one hand, I think for most people reading it, is quite pedestrian and one which they don't really pay that much attention to. But if you begin to think about it conceptually, here we have an attempted merger between Esav and Yishmael, a merger between, if I'll say it in terms of nationalistic, a merger between Christianity and Islam, that becomes something which is very frightening. By the way, pay attention. This week, when we read this week's portion, there was a major meeting between a representative, one of the highest ranking representatives of Islam, and the Pope. Think it's a coincidence? It's this week. The way to understand this, the way that historically we have understood this, has been multiple. And there are layers to it. There's one Gemara that points out, here's a perfect example of birds of a feather flocking together. By the way, it quotes that. It quotes that verse. You'll never find the verse, but it quotes it as a verse. It's actually from what's called wisdom literature. It's from a book called Ben Sira. It's one of the few cases that Gemara quotes something as scripture from outside of what we normally accept as scripture. It says it's written. It is written, such a verse. Birds of a feather like flock together. Okay. And therefore the attraction between Yishmael and Esav. The Tosafists over here on the verse, and Rashi tells us this in a comment to a verse in Yechezkel, bring a whole other side to this, another midrash, and they say as follows what happened. Esav's quite upset. The reason he's upset is because his brother stole his blessing. And he decides to do something purely in terms of military strategy or political intrigue. He says, I'm going to marry the daughter of Yishmael for the sole purpose of getting close to Yishmael. He wants to get close to him. Why does he want to get close to him? Because he wants to start having conversations with him late at night and talking about what it was like to lose the birthright. And as he starts to speak about what it's like to lose the birthright, he hopes to get Yishmael outraged because he too lost the birthright. And what he's going to try to do is to get Yishmael to do the dirty work for him, to do the one thing that maybe he can't do. And what's that? To kill Yitzchak. I know, we'd like to think that he honored his father. Yeah, he did honor him. He wasn't ready to kill him. But he was ready to get someone else to kill him. What does he say after Yaakov takes the blessing from him? He says, when the mourning for my father is over, then I'm going to kill Yaakov. But he was ready to engineer the mourning of his father. But it goes, it's a little bit better than that. What it says over here was his plan. He's going to get Yishmael all upset. Yishmael will then kill Yitzchak. What happens when Yishmael kills Yitzchak? Esav is a loving son. So what's he going to do? He'll avenge his father's death and then he'll kill Yishmael. Once he's killed Yishmael, the only one left is Yaakov. But Yaakov has no one to protect him, so then he'll kill Yaakov as well. And at that point, Esav will inherit everything from Yishmael and from Yaakov. Everything that belonged to Abraham will now belong to Esav. That was his plan. It actually says he's thinking about this as he's walking along the way, and he passes by the study hall of Shem. And Shem walks out and says, Esav, where do you get such ideas from? He goes, what are you talking about? He goes, this plot, when did you think about this, to have your father killed and so on? And he goes, who said this to you? He goes, God told me. And at that point, Esav gets intimidated and decides not to carry out his plan. There's another passage in the Talmud that tells us that it's a very strange description of Yishmael. It says, Esav went to Yishmael, and he took Machlas, Yishmael's daughter, Yishmael, the son of Avram, the sister of Nevios. Why is it the sister of Nevios? So it says that indeed he got engaged to the daughter of Yishmael, but before the marriage took place, Yishmael had died. And because Yishmael had died, it was Nevios who gave over the sister in the wedding. But that's also interesting, that we have an attempt to merge Esav and Yishmael. And what's the response? God says, I'm not letting this merger take place. This merger will be frustrated. This merger won't take place. And Yishmael dies before the merger can happen. There is, however, another aspect to this, which in order to get to, I need to jump a little bit, and you won't know why I'm going there. So you'll give me a couple of seconds. In the beginning of the last portion of the Torah, in Zos HaBracha, it says, Vayomer Hashem, God says, Misinai ba. Vayomer Hashem Misinai ba. God comes from Sinai. Vizarach me Seir lamo, hofi mi har paron. That God comes from Sinai and he appears as like a sun ray by Seir, and then appears in the mountain of Paran. So God comes from Sinai, goes to Seir, and then appears in Paran. Rashi over here tells us, what is the significance of Seir? That God offered the children of Seir the Torah, they didn't accept it. Then God goes to Paran, and he offers the children of Yishmael the Torah, and they didn't accept it. What Rashi's referring to over here is a Midrash which is quoted in a couple of different places, and it tells us that prior to approaching the Jewish people, God approached other nations. Specifically, what we're told is he approaches Esav, and he asks Esav, do you want the Torah? Esav asks, what does it say? And he's told what it says, and it says, no, thank you. He then goes to Yishmael, and he says, do you want the Torah? He says, what does it say? Ask what it says. When he's told what it says, he says, no, thank you. But it's interesting. Why would that be the sequence? Why would he first go to Esav and then Yishmael and not Yishmael and then Esav? The Zohar actually tells us that because of this offer, light came into the world. The Zohar says this because the verse that was quoted, it says, "Vayomer Hashem mi Sinai ba v'zorach mi Seir," that God came from Sinai and a light came shining out of Seir. That means that something happened at that point that caused the light to come into the world, and whatever that is something which seems completely, completely foreign to us. We don't understand what it is. What kind of light came from this rejection? Two sources, I don't know if they did this independently or one saw the other. One is a book called the Torah's Chaim, the other is in the comments of the Vilna Gaon. Both of us tell us, based on this passage of Zohar, that there's something very deep going on over here. And let me try to explain it. There's a Midrashic comment that there are a bunch of different types of names. There are people who have nice names and nice actions which match the names. There are people with bad names and bad actions, which match the names. There are people with bad names but good actions. And then there are people with good names and bad actions. To illustrate the people with really good names and bad actions, it picks up two people who you've become familiar with today. One is Esav and the other is Yishmael. And it says the name Esav is a good name because it indicates doing. Esav asui, to do. And it says the name Yishmael is a good name because Yishmael indicates to listen. I mean, if I think about Yishmael by itself, we like to look at the three forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We're told in the Mishnah in Avos that the world exists on three things: Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim. The world exists based upon Torah teaching, it's based upon service of God, which is Avodah, and it's based upon Chesed, performing of kind acts. Kind acts is associated with Avraham. Torah is associated with Yaakov. Yaakov is Yoshev Olam, sits in the tents and studies. Avodah, serving God, is represented by Yitzchak. Why? Well, probably because he was the first one who himself was supposed to be an offering. He lied on the altar. He himself was to be an offering. But it's very interesting. In today's world, we no longer have offerings. We no longer have korbanos. What do we have instead?
Prayer.
Now, the quintessential prayer, because I can say Abraham prayed, and Yaakov prayed, and Yitzchak prayed, and everybody prays, but who's the one who prays most clearly? Yishmael. God listens. Yishmael. God listens. And by the way, I want you to be very careful about this. I've said this before, and the point is not any weaker today. Today, the Jewish people have an enemy which is known as radical Islam. Radical Islam are people who are God-fearing people. They are people that pray. They don't pray three times a day. They pray five times a day. There are people who perform chesed. Both Hezbollah and Hamas made their reputations by performing all kinds of social programs in their respective countries. If the enemy was one which was morally depraved, so perhaps I'd feel a little bit more comfortable. And I know that you're not, that it's very hard what I'm saying right now. When an enemy is one where you feel you have moral superiority, it's very easy to turn to God and ask God for help. When you have an enemy where all the women dress in very, very modest clothing, when you have people that are performing acts of chesed, when you have people that pray to God and are quite sincere, that's a very dangerous enemy on a spiritual level. And if I'll just focus on the prayer for a moment, if we only pray three times a day, we better make sure that those three times we pray with more kavana, with more direction, with more intensity than they pray in their five times a day. Because Yishmael has an ability to get God's attention. That's a very frightening thing. Well, they eat at night. Otherwise, we wouldn't have an enemy. But again, we have to pay attention. And it means that we have to improve ourselves in all these kinds of areas to the point that we do feel that we have a moral superiority, that we can turn to God and ask to be completely victorious. The world is not as black as white and white as we would like it to be. So I realize that serving God is represented by Yitzchak, who is ready to be that first korban. Serving God in the contemporary idiom is prayer, which has a certain connection with Yishmael. Nonetheless, this medrash tells us that Esav represents doing, and Yishmael, see that? There was good timing on the prayer. And Yishmael represents the ability to hear. That's what it means. even though that in the biblical context, the ability to hear meant the ability to pray that God hears them, Yishma El, that God hears them, the quality of the name represents the idea of hearing. So what does all this have to do with us? God offers the Torah to Esav and to Yishmael. Esav says, no, thank you. According to at least one of the Midrashim, says, give it to the Jews. Just like Esav did not want to be the firstborn and didn't want to work in the temple and didn't want to be the one to take responsibility, let Yaakov be the one to go to Egypt. Let Yaakov be the one who's going to pay the difficult physical and moral price. Let him be the one. And Esav doesn't want any part of it. He doesn't want responsibilities. Esav wants a frivolous life. Esav wants vacations in Aruba. Esav wants to go to Cancun. Esav does not want to take responsibility. He opts out of a life of meaning and rather have a life which is easy. And he says, give it to Yaakov. Give it to Bnei Yisrael. Yishmael's offered the Torah. He says, no, thank you. The rules are a little too strict over here. Give it to Bnei Yisrael. The Vilna Gaon and the Torah's Chaim point out, when the Jews are offered the Torah, what do they say? Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do and we will listen. And they say the Na'aseh and the Nishma are connected to Esav and Yishmael. Na'aseh, we will do, is connected to the name Esav. V'nishma, we will listen, is connected to the name Yishmael. That whatever spiritual power Esav and Yishmael possessed, at that moment, when the Torah is given, a light comes into the world, and the Jewish people assume that light. They get the light. As a matter of fact, according to the way the Talmud describes it, the two crowns that the Jews get, again, you want to focus on the light? The crowns that the Jews get at Mount Sinai. The Jews say, Na'aseh v'nishma, and according to one version of the Talmud, it says that God says, who revealed the secret to my children? Who revealed the secret of the way that angels speak? Because what should they have said? They should have said, Nishma v'na'aseh. Tell us what it is, and then, if we like it, we'll accept and we'll do it. But they said, no, Na'aseh v'nishma. The same sequence, the same order, that God approaches Esav, and then God approaches Yishmael, and it's as if the Jews know, as if the Jews collectively understand. We have to do it, and then we'll listen. And by the way, it's interesting, because Na'aseh v'nishma, nishma is a very difficult word in Hebrew to know what the tense is. Nishma is ongoing present tense. I know if it's ongoing, you don't think it's present tense. How do you say this in a... It's hove mitmashechet. I think that's the term for it. It is ongoing present tense. Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do and we will continually listen to God. We will keep on listening to what God has to say. As far as we're concerned, Mount Sinai is never over. As far as we're concerned, we always listen to hear what is it that God is telling us. But where did we get this power? We got this power. We took the power of Esav and we took the power of Yishmael and we incorporated that. Again, think about it. In this week's portion, in the most dramatic moment, the climax of the story, Yaakov sneaks in surreptitiously. He's dressed up as Esav. And Yitzchak then says, why are you back so soon? And said, God provided. And he says, God? Esav is speaking about God? And he says, come, let me feel you. And he feels his hand, and it feels like Esav. And what does he say? He says, Hakol kol Yaakov v'yadayim yidei Esav. The voice is the voice of Yaakov and the hands are the hands of Esav. Does he say that with a question mark or with an exclamation point? Does he ask himself a question? Wow, I don't understand this. It sounds like Yaakov, but it feels like Esav. That's the way that I learned it when I was a kid. And I'm ready to reconsider that and to reject that. Because if Yitzchak is not sure who it is, then why continue and why give the blessing? You should stop, shut it down right then. I think instead he's saying something else. Wow. We can merge the two together. The Yadayim of Esav can be combined together with the Kol of Yaakov. That's an unbelievable combination. In fact, later on, when the Jewish people fight Amalek, Amalek is the descendant of Esav, Moshe is praying on the mountain, using the Kol Yaakov praying. But what else does he do as he prays? He lifts up his hands. He uses also the Yadayim. He uses the hands. And when he lifts his hands to heaven, we then have a merger. When you lift your hands and pray, you then have a merger of the Kol Yaakov and the Yadayim of Esav. And I think that's what Yitzchak was saying. Yitzchak was saying we need a merger. And initially, what did he think? That Yaakov and Esav can work together, and that was not going to happen. And after that didn't happen, then what does he think? That maybe Esav, this is by the way very sad, if you had to change one, what do you change? Do you say it's easier to give the guy who sits in yeshiva, give him hands and make him tough? Or is it easier to take the guy who's in the business world and give him some Yirah Shemayim, give him some spirituality? Apparently Yitzchak thinks it's easier to make Esav religious than to make Yaakov tough. That's a very sad comment. But what does he want? He wants the two of them to come together. Yaakov then takes responsibility for both, and it changes his life. Yaakov then becomes both. Hakol Yaakov and Yadayim of Esav. Yaakov doesn't back down anymore. Yaakov becomes strong. And we need a strong Yaakov. That's what Rivka understood. The blessing of physicality has to go to Yaakov. But there's still something spiritual about Esav that gets taken by Yaakov. That gets taken by the Jews at Mount Sinai. Na'aseh v'nishma. We get the spiritual power of Esav and the spiritual power of Yishmael, and a light comes into the world at that point. The light, we're told, are the crowns the Jews get. What happens to those crowns? Unfortunately, we end up acting just like Esav. And what happens? Moshe goes up to the mountain. What do? We make a golden calf. What happens when we make the golden calf? God takes away the crowns. What happened to those crowns? Rashi in the Gemara tells us that those crowns, all of them, are given to Moshe. And that was the light that was on Moshe. That's what Rashi says. The light which is on Moshe is the same light that we're talking about over here. All of the light goes on to Moshe, and he becomes the representative of the people. He's the one who brings the Torah down from heaven. He's the one, in one person, who combines together the hands and the voice. But one day we're told that this light will return to the Jewish people. And this is the light that we took from Yishmael. One day, and from Esav. One day, the children of Esav. One day, the children of Yishmael will come back and recognize that they may have made a mistake. And at that point, they'll come and they'll try to help us. And at that point, the vision that Yitzchak sees will come to fruition. Have a good Shabbos.